6-6 Bhagavad Gita, Bandhur Atman Atmanastasyaha. Yena Maivatmanam Jitaha. Anatmanastu Shatruve. Varte tad maiva shatruvat. Bandhur. Friend. Atma. The mind. Atmana. The living entity. Tasya. Of him. Yena. By whom. Atma. The mind. Eva. Certainly. Atmana, by the living entity. Jita, conquered. Anatmana, of one who has failed to control the mind. Two, but Shatruve, because of enmity. Varteta, remains. Atma eva, the very mind, Shatruvat, as an enemy. Translation, one who has conquered the mind is the best of friends. One who has failed to do so, his mind will remain the greatest enemy. Purport, the purpose of practicing Eightfold Yoga is to control the mind in order to make it a friend in discharging the human mission. Unless the mind is controlled, the practice of yoga for show is simply a waste of time. One who cannot control his mind lives always with his greatest enemy, and thus his life and his mission are spoiled. The constitutional position of the living entity is carry out the orders of the superior. As long as one's mind remains an unconquered enemy, one has to serve the dictations of lust, anger, greed, illusion, etc. When the mind is conquered, one voluntarily agrees to abide by the dictation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is situated in everyone's heart as Paramatma. Real yoga practice entails meeting the Paramatma within the heart and then following his dictation. For one who takes the Krishna consciousness directly, perfect surrender to the dictation of the Lord automatically follows. So yesterday we spoke a little bit about the importance of controlling the mind and using the mind in the right way. This verse continues with the same point. But we want to speak a little bit about the mind in general, because it's such a complex. And to know how it works means to be able to see it. And then once you can see your mind and how it's working, it becomes easier to control it and ultimately direct it in the right direction. Generally, everyone is controlled by the mind, and therefore the mind is the, what we say, commander-in-chief. It makes the living entity go wherever the mind goes. And therefore, the mind dictates to the living entity everything. And this one is led around by the mind. And one is thinking, mistakenly, at least the conditioned soul is thinking that, you know, I'm thinking like this, I'm doing like this, and that. But actually, the mind is doing it. And the mind is connected to the modes of material nature according to its nature. When the mind is in a selfless position, it's connected to the mode of goodness. When the mind's in a selfish position, it's connected to the mode of passion. And when the mind is in a destructive position, it's in the mode of ignorance, like that. Or it's being affected by the different modes it's connected to. So we might want to use an example to help you understand the difference between the soul and the mind, because if you don't, you'll start mixing one for the other. We can use a nice example, and this, think about this. There's the vast, clear sky. But then again, when you look up in the sky, you see clouds. Sometimes you see birds. Sometimes there's planes or objects flying in the sky. And you might also see from a distance impressions upon the sky of like buildings or mountains or something. None of that touches the sky at all. All the objects within the sky do not touch the sky, but they appear to be in the sky. So in the same way, the thoughts of the mind are impressions upon the vast sky of the soul. The soul is the expansive consciousness, which is everywhere. But the thoughts and images that the mind projects are like the different images you see within the sky. So they never, just like the mind never touches the soul, but at the same time appears to be. So in the same way, when we look up in the sky, we see objects. When they move, sometimes they're stationary. So in the same way, the mind picks up thoughts, ideas, impressions, emotions, and it imprints them upon the soul. But the soul is not touched by that, but because it identifies with the thoughts of the mind, it becomes affected by that. Therefore, it becomes entangled into the different levels of material energy. So if you can remember that consciousness is vast, expansive, but the mind is the impressions that come and go within the conscious mind. So your thoughts go in, your thoughts go out, your thoughts sometimes don't appear. So just like one time you'll see certain objects in the sky, and then the next time you look again, they're gone, or new objects are there. So this way thoughts come in and out of the mind. The mind is always moving. It's amorphous. It has a tendency to move. It keeps moving, keeps moving, it keeps moving. It doesn't stop. Therefore, if the mind is not engaged, it will look for engagement in some way or other through the material energy. Even if it's, so the mind has to be connected to something at some time at every second. Even when you're sleeping, which is a different state of consciousness, this is called swapna. Swapna means dream. Therefore, in the state of dreaming, your mind is also moving through different images. And you're seeing the images in the dream. But who is the person who's seeing, and who is that person in the dream that you see? You see yourself in the dream many times. But what is being seen is the impression of yourself, and what is seeing is you, the soul. So the soul at night sees in the dream state the different images that appear, and you get, and these images are impressions of your waking reality, and your personal identification or the experiences you've had in the material existence. Now there's another state of consciousness, because there's three levels. There is waking, dreaming, and deep sleep. Deep sleep, the mind is also working, but because it's on such a subtle level of activity, it's called the delta waves. There are different waves. There are gamma waves, there's beta waves, there's alpha waves, there's delta waves. So when it goes onto the very slowest of all the waves, that is called deep sleep. And that's the most restful time, when the mind actually rests, although it's still functioning, but on the slower level. Meditation is also on the delta level, where there is awareness, but at the same time the mind is still. That's what meditation really is that you can still the mind down to where it doesn't move, but it, at the same time it's completely aware. And therefore, in that awareness, it projects certain images that you focus on, such as if you meditate on the lotus feet of the Lord, if you're meditating on the holy name. So these are the different states of consciousness that the mind will take you in and out of, like that. When you were born, all the functions of the mind are there, but you don't know how to use them. At the very beginning stages of our life, the functions of the mind are already there, because mind is not something that develops. It is something that is already developed from our previous life, but we can't use it because of the awareness of existence is so low due to our small type body, and therefore we can't function. You'll see some babies are more aware of other things than other babies at the same age. It's like Srila Prabhupada. He said, when I was 6 months old, I can still remember when I was 6 months old. Now this is Prabhupada. I was sitting on the lap of my auntie, and she was doing the knitting, you know, making clothes with the needle like that. So he said when he was 6 months, he could still remember his 6-month-year-old baby. Of course, that's a self-realized soul, has such power of the mind. So, yeah, but can we remember back that far? Can we remember even back as far as even our early childhood, some of the impressions that we had? We might be able to go, by the strength of our mind, we might be able to go back pretty far. But as the age goes, and then the consciousness starts to develop more, then the use of the mind becomes more frequent like that. And then we're using the mind at every moment. Although the mind is always working, we can't always remember it. So this is a little bit about the nature of the mind. In the mind there are thoughts. The thoughts reflect desires. They reflect experiences, and they reflect impressions. They reflect emotions. So the mind is a combination of these different aspects of our existence, thoughts of experiences like that. So the mind is thinking, feeling, and willing. This is the basic. This is psychology 101. That you think about something, and then you get a feel for it. And as that feeling grows, then you either act or don't act, depending on what is called the other function of the mind, called kalpa, sankalpa vikalpa. Sankalpa vikalpa means to accept, and vikalpa means to reject. So we think of something, we get a feel for it, and then we either act on it or don't act on it according to our own value system, you know, or even our own desires like that. So watching the thoughts of the mind means to see how to direct those thoughts in the right way, or to eliminate those thoughts and bring in the thoughts that are Krishna conscious or positive. So one of the ways to do that is to watch your mind. Instead of being dragged by the mind, just sit there and just see where your mind is going to go. Sometimes it stops just to fool you, to let you know I'm not doing anything. But it does. It's always doing something. It can't stop. There's no way. The mind is a series of points. It goes from one point to another point to another point to another point. And I'll give you an example how the mind works, and I'm sure you all have an experience like that. You're sitting in the temple, you're chanting japa, and then some person walks in, and you think about something about that person, and then that leads to another thought related to that person, and then something that related to that thought will take you in relationship to that thought to somewhere else. For instance, you say, oh, well, there is that friend of mine. And then, oh, I'm so happy they came to the temple. But then again, the last time I saw them was when we were out together in Ljubljana Square. But then what we did when we were there, we were actually, you know. So you're just going from one point to another, starting off with you seeing this impression of a person. And this is how the mind moves from one thing to another, to another, to another, to another, another. And it'll just keep going like that. So that's why we have, sometimes we have a lot of trouble chanting japa, because the mind is always moving. It's always moving. Samadhi means to keep the mind in place without movement for 2 minutes and 44 seconds. If you can control the mind and focus it for 2 minutes and 44 seconds, you have reached the beginning state of samadhi. So before then, there is concentration, there is meditation, there is absorption, like that. So it's not easy to control the mind. Therefore, we always have to be directing the mind to something spiritual. And through that, and spiritual is not something that is part of the three modes of the material energy. So the effect of spiritual, that is it actually gives serenity and peace and happiness to the mind. And when that happens, the mind slows down. So in spiritual life, the tendency is that the mind will slow down. Or you'll have a better control of the activities of the mind and you'll be able to direct it easily wherever you want to direct it. So therefore, we're working with some personality we call the mind. And it's very active. It doesn't stop for even a second. Sometimes you tell the mind, think of nothing. Just tell your mind, think of nothing. And what is it going to do? It's going to think of something. It's going to think about thinking of nothing. That's what it's going to do. It can't think of nothing, but it'll think about thinking of nothing. So these are just some of the examples of how the mind is. In the beginning of the Shikshastika prayers, in the first verse, it says, Cheto Dharpanam Marjanam. Cheta means mind, Dharpanam means mira, and Marjanam means to cleanse. So the first principle, or the first benediction for chanting the holy name, it cleanses the mirror of the mind. So again, well, how is the mind referred to as a mirror? Interesting. So here's another aspect of the mind. It reflects inside what's outside. In other words, no two people see the external environment in the same way. I'm seeing the reality in the environment in one way, you're seeing it in another way. We have a similar understanding of the environment. But because we have a certain conditioned nature, we reflect that on the images that we see, and therefore we have a slightly different, or even sometimes a completely different, view or experience of the external environment. That's why it says the mirror of the mind. Just like if you're angry, a lot of times you'll see people around you seem to be the same way. If you're happy, everyone looks happy. So, in other words, the mind will reflect inside what's outside inside, or I mean inside what's outside. So there is one reality, which is objective. And there's so many subjective realities which are all wrong, because they're subjective. They're wrong because there are my impressions of the external environment, just like that. But you know, sometimes you see an image, and you look at it from one angle, it looks like one thing. You look at it from another angle, it looks like completely different. There's that exercise, they have this image of this elderly lady. You look at it, it looks like an old lady, but then if you look at it from another angle, it's a young girl. It's the same image, it depends on how you perceive the image. One way it looks like an old lady, another time it's a young woman. So it's from the angle of vision. So the picture doesn't change, it's just your perception of the picture that changes from like that. So our perception of this world is that I am the center and the world is out there for my enjoyment. And that's the conditioned nature's... Everything around me is for my use and for my enjoyment. That's the conditioned nature. The spiritual nature is everything belongs to the Supreme Lord because He's created everything. And everything is meant to be used in His service. And I am His servant, so my job is, or my connection with the Lord, is take the objects of the external environment and learn how to use them in His service. So the materialists, they see the world as being, they see themselves as being the center and everything around them to be their use, whereas the devotees see Krishna as the center and everything to be used in Krishna's service. So it's a completely different consciousness like that. And so there is one reality, and Krishna mentions that in the Bhagavad Gita in the fourth chapter, where after the verse Tadviri Pratipatena, in the next verse he says, when you thus learn the truth, you'll know that all living beings are in me, they are my parts and parcels, and they are mine. So real vision means to see everything as the energy of Krishna and all living entities as pure spiritual beings. That is the pure consciousness beyond all the subjective consciousness that the different living entities will adopt in their interaction with the material energy, like that. So unless we come to that consciousness, we haven't really come to Krishna consciousness yet. And we see everything in relationship to Krishna, and everything, Krishna is within everything. Andantarastam paramam chayantarastam. He's also in the atoms. He's manifested everywhere throughout existence. And one can, it says that one who has purified vision sees the objects of the external world, but that they see Krishna within the object at the same time. They can see both the object and Krishna within the object. That's pure spiritual vision like that. But we can do it from a theoretical understanding that we see everything in relationship to Krishna and everything is Krishna's energy to be used in Krishna's service. And that's the verse, Chaito Darpanam Marjanam. Marjanam means to clean. So the mirror is dusty. What is that dust? Lust, anger, greed, illusion, pride, envy, fear, so many. These are the dust particles that are covering the mirror of the mind. So the holy name is like the broom that cleans, or like the rag that wipes the dust away from the mirror of the mind. And when the mirror of the mind is completely clean, the mind becomes what is called clear consciousness. Clear consciousness is the stage before Krishna consciousness. In other words, we're seeing everything as it is. The next stage is to see Krishna within everything. That is this Krishna conscious stage. So, premanjaritam bhakti vilochanena satasa daiva rideyesha vilokayanta yam shama sundara achinta guna sarupam govindamari purusham tamaham bhajami. When the eyes are smeared with the ointment of love, then one can see Krishna everywhere. So, love is that ointment that brings what we say, Krishna vision, or spiritual, pure spiritual vision. When we try to love in this world, we have a limited vision of the object that we are attracted to based on our desire to enjoy. So that is not actually love, that is just a feature of our desire to enjoy, which translates into lust, like that. So these are some of the functions of the mind. So, and then we can take the different categories of the mind. There's the rational mind, then the emotional mind, the waking mind, the dreaming mind, the sleep mind, like that. And in the Bhagavad time, it calls karmatmaka. It's another name for the mind. Karmatmaka means colored. I don't know if you had the same experience in your country, but in America many years ago, and still people do it, there was this big fad that was going around. People were wearing different colored glasses. And they were, you had green lenses, you had purple lenses, yellow lenses, red lenses. So you put them on and the environment looks the color of the lens you're looking through. So the mind is like that. It's called karmatmaka, colored by conditioned nature. And therefore, back to that same point, we see the world through these colored lenses, which are all wrong, like that. The mind is independent of the body, and you can see that when you sleep. The body is laying still and the mind is moving. Sometimes we travel out of the body, and you can see that there are severe operations sometimes where people on the operating table, they actually rise out of their body and can watch the operation. There are examples of that. There was one operation where one lady, she had an operation, she traveled and watched it. And then when she came back down, she chastised the doctor. She was under an anesthesia, therefore the doctor was wondering, how is she chastising me? But she said, you did a night operation, but you're using such bad language when you were working. He was using bad language. So he was thinking, how does she know that? Well, she had traveled outside of her body, and she was in a different part of the same room, watching the operation from a different place. I mean, I have a friend who was a devotee. He said he used to do that quite often when he was small. Little kids can do that even. They can travel out of their body and watch their body from a different place in the same room like that. So the mind can do that. The mind is so powerful, it can take the soul out of the body. The body still remains, but the soul and the mind are always connected. To break the mind-body connection is not so hard, but to break the soul-mind connection is very hard. In fact, that's what it takes to get liberation, when the soul has to free themselves from the conditioned mind and ultimately attain the state of pure mind. And then the soul is no longer dragged or forced by the mind in any particular direction. Am I putting you all to sleep? Am I tired or something? They say when the speaker is tired, everybody else sleeps. Should we change the subject? Is this too boring? I know it's very philosophical and it can be kind of boring. But if you can stay away, that would really help the speaker. I know when you're all working hard all day and then you sit down and you relax and that's what I'm waiting for. That moment to slow down. But it doesn't help the speaker at all like that. And then, so out-of-body travel is quite frequent. People have it. Not everybody has it, but people have it. I had an experience like that when I was small. So everybody can, I think maybe all of us do. Of course, we travel out of the body when we dream at night. But we can even do it in this waking realm. We can travel out. And then there's another feature called near-death experience. I don't know if you've heard of that, NDE. There's books written about that, where people actually die. Their physical body stops. And then their mind enters into another realm of existence and they're traveling through this realm. A lot of times all the realms that they travel through can be very frightening, or it can be very pristine and enlivening. But somehow or other, because it wasn't their time to die, they come back. And then they remember how they traveled into these different realms and then came back. I remember one person was telling me they traveled and they saw these men dressed in black. And they were going down this long tunnel. It was very frightening. So that frightening experience caused them to again re-enter their body like that. So near-death experiences are usually mercy manifestations of the Lord to show people what is their future when they die. Because what is the fear of death? Can anybody say, why do we fear death?
We don't know what will happen.
Yeah, we don't know where we're going to go. You know, we always plan on where we're going to go and what we're going to do when we get there. But death tells us you're under my control and you don't know where you're going to go. So that's the fear of death. To die is not so bad, but the entering into the unknown is a very frightful thing, and therefore people are fearful of the unknown. And so these near-death experiences that people have, they get a little idea of what is their destination when they die. And then they come back and then they have a chance to change their life. If that so-called experience is a negative experience, they can change their life and therefore they can change their destination. Some people do that, others don't. They just go on with their same life. Women who have difficulties at childbirth, and many of them have dear, I know, I remember, I met one lady, she had 3 near-death experiences each time she gave birth to a child. She left her body and then came back. Later on, she wrote a book describing 7 different kinds of near-death experiences. And these are all the movements of the mind. You have to understand how the mind is moving through different realms of existence based on emotions, desires, attractions, attachments. So this is all some of the workings of the mind. So then, therefore, in this verse it says, one has to conquer the mind by and make the mind the best of friends. And the best friend means one who knows your best interest. So your mind has to be engaged in such a way or directed in such a way that it brings you to Krishna consciousness or to the spiritual activities. So knowing how the mind works helps you to somehow or other direct it. Even when you're sleeping, if you have enough power, even in dreams, you can overcome the destination of the dream. The dream might be pulling you in a certain way, and you can fight against that by your, in other words, people who have strong minds, or what we say purified minds, they can somehow or other see themselves in the dream and change the experience by waking up, usually. It's usually by waking up. Like that. So the mind is really the only friend and the only enemy. So when it takes us to Krishna, and to purify the mind means to chant Hare Krishna. We shouldn't, well, we might think, well, I'm chanting Hare Krishna, my mind is still like a garbage dump, you know. It's got, you know, still got comic books in there, and still got, you know, rock and roll songs. Still got images of my girlfriend back 20 years ago. It's got so many things in there. So, but cleaning the consciousness is like cleaning a piece of coal. You know what coal is? You know, that's black stuff you burn. You keep cleaning and it still just keeps looking black. So don't give up. Even if you find yourself, you know, your mind is just like, whoa, I didn't know that was there. What birth was that? So don't be discouraged, because as we mentioned, there's 3 states of the mind, but there's 2 categories of the mind. One is consciousness and one is unconsciousness. We function about 10 to 15% on the conscious level. 85% of our mind is on the unconscious level. Example is a computer. When you turn on your computer, what's up on the screen is just one small part of the information that's there within the hard drive. There's so much. But you can't see that. All you can see is what's up on the screen. But you know, by pushing different buttons, different images and different informations will come up on the screen. So this mind has so much on the unconscious level that we're not even aware of. impressions, desires, experiences, everything is there, emotions. And many times it'll come to the surface. It comes to the surface in dreams. It comes to the surface just, they call it deja vu. You've heard of that? Deja vu. Oh, an experience that you can't really connect to in this life, but actually it's coming from previous lives. Like that. So there, yeah. So the whole process of mind control is to realize you're dealing with a very complex monster. He's powerful. And he'll come, and you don't know what's in there, but you want to get rid of some of it and replace it with spiritual thoughts, spiritual impressions, spiritual desires. And that's the process of Krishna consciousness. That's why the process usually is a gradual process. It doesn't happen overnight. It's something that happens after some time. So just keep working, but keep watching your mind and don't let your mind control you. Control the mind. When the mind is bored, it says, all right, I'll go to sleep. You know, nothing out here to interest me anyway, so I might as well just take rest. That's a sign of boredom. Or the mind. The mind is also an organ, and our mind can get tired. It says that those who work with the mind need more sleep than those who work with the physical body. Yes, because the mind can also make you exhausted. You see that when you push your mind sometimes on the computer or some other process of thinking. The mind can get tired, it does get tired. And one of the tricks of the mind is that when you try to control it, and it doesn't want to get be controlled, it shuts down and says, I'm out of here. It just goes, and you think, what happened? I can't control it, and I can't even find it anymore. It's just not functioning. So the mind is not only... It is like a little kid that is spoiled. That's a good definition of a mind. Or it's like a barrel of monkeys that are all sitting in this one big room, and no monkey is doing the same thing as the other monkey. They're all jumping different ways. So that's the nature of the mind. Just like I'm talking, how many times have you actually diverted your attention to something else during this class? Count it. Sometimes you can just count it. So it's just that that's how the mind works. It's very difficult to control. But when you focus your mind on the lotus feet of the Lord, then the mind is fixed. And if you can keep that impression into your mind, then your mind will always be in the best position. And we'll speak about transcendental consciousness in one of the two upcoming classes. We have two more classes after this. Today I just wanted to give you a little bit about the workings of the mind so you know what you're dealing with. It's just, and there's much more. In substance, the mind is like ether or space. It's expansive, open, all-pervading. In movement, the mind is like the wind. It controls simultaneously inner and outer physical activity. In illumination, the mind is like fire. It has understanding. It sheds light. It can perceive. In emotion, it's like water, feelings of empathy and emotional experiences. In weight, mind is like memory and attachments. Memory is weighty, attachments are weighty. So you can see the different categories within the mind like that. And then there's, this is a little revolutionary. We say that there is the inner mind, outer mind, and intermediate mind. And this is coming more from the yoga categories. Inner minds are feeling and intuition. You get feelings, you have intuitive, intuitive thoughts. That's where spiritual life really starts to begin. The outer minds are the senses, the emotions, and gathering impressions from the environment. Their intermediate mind is what come you bring inside, when we bring outside in, and then you bring inside out. So it's like a transitional part of the mind where thoughts are going in and out. It's like they call it the intermediate mind. It meditates between sensory, transcendentary sensory impressions and emotions on one side and deep and abiding internal feelings on the other. So that, I'll read it again. The intermediate mind meditates between transient sensory impressions, transient sensory impressions, and emotions on one side. So on one side, it meditates on these sensory impressions and emotions, and on the other side, deep and abiding internal feelings on the other, combination of the external and internal. Reason and perception equals what? When you have reason and you have perception based on the reason, what is the result? I'll ask you that question. You're reasoning, and then you perceive something by the reasoning, what's the conclusion? Well, action, but just what precedes action? Yeah, that's decision, right. Or we say, what's the word here? Judgment. Judgment, decision, evaluation. Yeah, good. The inner mind deposits the feelings attached to the object. The intermediate mind is intelligence, and the outer mind is sense experience, sense perception, like that. Okay. Well, there's a lot here. I've got 10 pages of notes here. So. We'll also speak about the austerities of the mind. And we have to practice mental austerities, otherwise we can't be able to control that mind. The austerities are tools for controlling the mind. Like that. And that's mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita. I'll list them so you get an idea of what they are. We won't discuss them tonight because we don't have the time. The austerities of the mind are satisfaction, gravity, simplicity, and self-control. These are the austerities of the mind. And purification of one's existence. This is from Bhagavad Gita, chapter 17, verse number 16. Okay, so we have approximately 10 minutes or a little more. Any questions?
Yes, one question on the internet. I have a question, if possible. Is it possible that in some point, more you chant with japa, more you notice your mind, and more your mind is becoming like a crazy monkey?
Well, what's happening is, this is an experience the devotees go through. That crazy monkey is that the chanting of the holy name is like the fire, and the mind is like butter. So you put butter on fire, and that's how you make ghee. Slow fire. So the slow fire separates the fat from the clarified part of the butter, and then the fat goes to two places. It goes to the top and stays on the bottom, but generally it comes to the top. So when you're chanting Hare Krishna, this is a good analogy, you're starting to bring out those things in your mind that are actually your attachments, your material desires. They're coming to the forefront. And what do you do with those? You let them go. In other words, you let them go, you don't look at them, you don't meditate them, just let them go. Just like a horse is running. So it's been running for a long time, but then it passes in front of you, and at the time it passes in front of you, you see it. But when it keeps going, you don't see it anymore. So these thoughts will come from the unknown, pass to the conscious awareness, and then keep, let it keep going out like that. So yeah, and then there's another principle is that when you're chanting, you're trying to control the mind, or the holy name is pulling the mind towards the sound, and the mind doesn't want that. It still wants to do what it wants. So sometimes it fights. And that's part of the craziness of the mind. It's fighting the idea of being controlled. We think, oh, when I'm not chanting, I'm okay. But when I'm chanting, what happens? I'm crazy. No. Just like when you're, you know, when you go to the doctor, you may find yourself have a severe disease. And you may not even experience the effects of the disease, but when the doctor tells you, well, you do have this cancer, and therefore we need to operate. So the operation is painful, but it's part of getting rid of the disease. So that painfulness is the it appears to be difficult, but it's the purification that is being used to bring the mind to the state of sudasattva, or pure consciousness. Pure goodness. Okay, you got the microphone, so what's next?
So, Hare Krishna, in relation to this, you mentioned that by chanting, our anarthas are coming out.
They can. You can also see them.
Yes, that's what I'm experiencing as well. So then, like, you know, you can ask yourself how to rectify this, because this anartha, this is our false ego, this is our habits, which needs to be...
That's the process of bhakti. Devotional service means to get rid of these things. So devotional service is active service and purification of the mind through the process of hearing and chanting the glories of the Lord. You have to do both. If you just hear and chant, that's nice, but doing the active service purifies, will bring that purification more direct, because you're actually using your mind and senses in practical activity. But then you have to hear and chant also. The thing is, you have to. It's a two part or two aspects, sadhana and seva. Because sadhana equals seva, and seva and sadhana together equals sadhya. Sadhya means gold. What is the goal? If you just do sadhana, you get some benefit. But you won't be able to reach, because when you're doing sadhana, you're really asking for seva. And if you're just doing seva and you don't do sadhana, then seva can also become like work. It's sadhana that makes seva transcendental.
Mm-hmm. So by doing practical seva, we are getting some attachment, developing some good qualities.
Yeah.
But what about those bad qualities?
Bad qualities, they have no substance. They're just like clouds. Just like you see a cloud, but when the wind comes, the cloud blows away. Or when the sun comes out, the sun destroys the clouds. Yeah. These bad qualities are not real. Good qualities are real. Bad qualities is simply a covering over the good qualities, that's all. Just like, what is darkness?
The remaining of the light.
The what?
The remaining of the absence of the light.
Absence of the light, right. So darkness has no substance. It's just the absence of light. So these bad qualities have no substance, they're just the absence of good qualities. That's all. Same with cold. What is cold? Cold is simply the absence of heat. That's all.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else?
I had one question more. If you have time, I'll work tomorrow.
Yeah, we consider the end of the class when the curtain closes.
Ah, okay. So, a little bit different. Like, I was thinking when you were mentioning dreaming. Like, sometimes we can have dreaming, like, there is also in some purpose that by dreaming, sometimes we can fulfill through dreaming some karmic desires. So we don't need to leave it. This is one perspective. And sometimes the dreams are blurred. Sometimes the dreams, you can get even some realizations. I got some realizations which helped me to change. So then the question would be, either there are one source or more sources of dreams, and what is the goal, the meaning?
Dreams have a few complex meanings behind it. It's not just one way. Could be just impressions thrown together from the waking reality, now they're reappearing in the dream state. It could be that you, as you say, you have certain desires, and then you're not fulfilling those desires on the waking stage. Jai Panchatattva Ki Jai. You're not fulfilling those desires on the waking stage, but because the desires are strong, you fulfill them in the dream. That's one way. So dreams are not just one way. You can't just say, well, dream is like this. It could be different things that inspire dreams. Like that.
But where they're coming from? From Paramatma proofs?
They're coming from the unconscious mind due to impressions and desires. That's all.
Just like impression, like you mentioned the other day.
Yeah, impressions, desires, experiences.
Like artificially.
Some of it actually simply reflects our desires, and others it just makes no sense at all. Yeah, Prabhupada gives the example in the Krishna book. He says, you see a mountain and you see gold. So in the dream you see a golden mountain. Because you have impressions of both gold and mountain, the dream throws it together into a golden mountain. So it really has no meaning. But then there's other dreams that are simply unfulfilled desires on the waking level. So we're fulfilling them through the dream state.
And where are those dreams are coming from?
Well, of course, other things too. People can also transfer their negative thoughts to you through association with you. Just like it says you shouldn't eat grains cooked by non-devotees, because then you'll start to dream a little bit, you'll get their karmic consciousness through your dreams. So you might get some crazy dream based on your eating food cooked by non-devotees. That's Prabhupada very strongly admonishes us. Do not take food cooked by the non-devotees, because you pick up their karma, you can also have these crazy dreams like that. Or, another thing, sometimes you have a very strong impression on the waking level and it stays with you and it reappears again on the dream state. Like every time I dream every night because Mother Somadhatri cooks for me, but I always dream about devotees. I'm thinking, this is pretty good, but I hope it doesn't change, you know. So, based on my cook, I get dreams one way or the other, you know. Sometimes I get no dreams, and that's the best state. But yeah, just like the one of our spiritual masters. He was eating some cooking by one of his disciples. And then he said afterwards, he said, it wasn't a dream, but he was just experiencing it on the waking level. He said, "Are you listening to Beatles songs?" And she said, "Guru Maharaj, how did you know?" Well, and you know, it's in her consciousness, and when she's cooking, he's eating, and then it comes into his consciousness. And then I can't get, you know, and then the Beatles song is playing. So yeah, the mind can pick up. So therefore, association is very, very important. Be careful of who you associate with and how you associate with them. Because their mental impressions and their desires can also affect you in one way or the other. That's why we should always keep association with devotees. Okay? Yes.
So you said that the dreams are like a product of our impressions. But what about in the case of such elevated souls as Srila Prabhupada, when he dreamt of his Guru Maharaj that he has to take?
That's spiritual. Prabhupada says if you dream of something spiritual, that's Krishna conscious. It can, or it can come by the strength of your own spiritual. It comes by your own spiritual strength. Sometimes if you dream about Prabhupada, you dream about Krishna, that's as good as your activities on the waking level. But then again, there's also a trick dream. Sometimes there are personalities who appear in your mind and take images of God or the spiritual master and trick you. That can happen too. And how do you know what is the real dream and what is the false dream? Is the activities of the person and the dream is the same. If there's an activity different in the dream than what that person would normally does, then you know it's not. Yeah, there was one devotee was telling me, "Oh, I'm dreaming of Prabhupada, and I'm sitting with Prabhupada, and I put my head on Prabhupada's lap, and he strokes my head, and I feel so. I said, "That's not Prabhupada." She said, "No, that's Prabhupada." I said, "Prabhupada doesn't do that." So she was persistent. Then finally she came to me, she said, "You're right." In the dream, Prabhupada again came and he started becoming angry and started smashing everything. So then I realized it was a ghost. So that's how you tell what is an actual spiritual dream. The understanding doesn't change in the dream state from what is on the waking state. Mine's tricky. But you can tell by the nature of the dream whether it's some ghost imitating or it's actually, you know, Prabhupada or Krishna or some spiritual personality appearing in your mind. Yeah. So, okay, I'm sorry if I interfered with your mental process here for an hour, anyway. I hope we can have some nice dreams tonight. Dream about Krishna. It says the residents of Vrindavan, they work hard all day serving Krishna, and at night that's all they do is dream about Krishna. There are devotees, many devotees who have, they dream spiritual things every night. Or when they're dreaming, it's always like that. And there's others, and some of their dream states are rated X. You don't want to talk about some of those. Hare Krishna. So be careful. What you do on the waking level will affect what happens on the dreaming state. Always keep good association and never eat food cooked by non-devotees, even if it's parents or others. Okay. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.